So welcome to part two of two with Steve Hamilton, who, if you haven't heard the first episode, go and have a listen to that, talking about recording Kid A with Radiohead. And he talks here about working with Noel Gallagher, working with Aretha Franklin, loads and loads of people, absolute legend, love him. He's also been in Madness for years and years as well, actually. There's just so much to cover with Steve's career. As mentioned now, I'm offering one-to-one live coaching sessions for anybody who's interested, opening that up internationally now to listeners. So I've got qualifications in kind of emotional intelligence, in well-being, in mental health. So if anybody wants any support, just drop us an email, stageleftnights@gmail.com, and we'll see what we can do, either one-to-one stuff or happy to kind of do group stuff within organizations as well. So give us a shout about that. Okay, it's also the fifth anniversary of the podcast as well. So it'd be great if you want to send in some messages that I can read out online about favourite episodes, etc., etc. Find us on Twitter at The Stage Left Pod, Facebook at facebook.com/The Stage Left Podcast, and our Instagram page as well, which has got loads of behind-the-scenes content, which is The Stage Left Podcast. So I'm going to record a kind of bonus episode of that in the coming days. Okay, let's get back to Steve Hamilton.
So, talking about not being alive, let's get on to. I wanted to ask you about Quentin Tarantino, and because he obviously kills a lot of people in his films. And how he said this quote about writing film music, because I know you've written a lot of music for films, which he was once pressed on Jonathan Ross's show about why he uses old kind of archive songs that we all know rather than get some. I mean, he's changed it recently, but rather than get someone to write music. And he wouldn't admit the answer. And then Jonathan Ross, bless him, kept prodding, and eventually went, I don't want someone having more power over my film than me. Which is interesting. Yeah. A great insight into the relationship between the person writing music on a film and a director, and how that can be, the interpretation can be changed. So when it comes to writing film music, has there ever been a time where you've been given something like some images and you have written a piece and it's completely reinterpreted what the director wanted? Or is there...
It's funny you should say that, because I know a very, very similar person to who would rather, who has used me for film composition, for various things. And I know he wants to write the music himself. But can't, and has no ability to do so, but desperately wants to, and is very, very just wants to be in control of that entirely, which is not an unhealthy thing. You notice I'm not going to mention his name.
No, I can tell.
I'm really hedging around this.
Yeah.
He's not the only person, but I love it when people, I consider that quite controlling. But Tarantino is an absolute genius, and his musical supervision, because he is a musical supervisor as well as being a director and screenwriter and general genius. He wants to remain in utter control, and I think that can be quite stifling. And we got Morricone to do that with Hateful Eight, which I hated the film, to be honest.
Same.
Yeah, I didn't like his last film either.
Same.
But I love the music he chucks in most of the. Pulp Fiction Forever will be one of the masterpieces.
Django, though, I was a big fan of Django. Django Unchained was great.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I enjoyed that. But it's hit and miss a lot of that stuff. But getting back to the music thing.
How are you in that situation? What's the relationship between you and the director of the film? And are you given quite a clear blueprint of like, this is what this scene is about, or is it kind of just left to you to do?
I think, well, in the lot, I've written this album that I've done is the first kind of standalone thing that I've ever done. Actually, I've done so many TV commercials and short films, feature film, and hundreds of documentaries and things for the BBC and stuff, but it's the first time. Every now and again, when you get given a brief, certainly in a commercial, doing a TV commercial, it'll be so specific that they'll have something that they want it to sound very similar to, or they actually say, can you just get really near it, you know, without going into court, kind of thing. Which is obviously the worst thing you want to hear, because then you've got, you want the money, you know, and you know, those sort of things pay quite well, but you can't. So you've got no freedom at all, and you're chained to this existing temp score they've put in. What's lovely is a friend of mine, Fiona Lloyd-Davis, who works for the BBC and as an independent film maker as well, great photographer as well. But she, I've probably done about maybe 40 documentaries with her.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, lots of documentaries, series for Newsnight, and lots and lots of things for her. And she's always just said, just do what you do, you know. And that she...
Trusts you.
Yeah, and you know, there'll be things that she says, oh, no, I don't like that one, but can you, you know, nuance that slightly or finesse that. But not at all controlling. And it's a pleasure to work for someone and immediately sends you feedback saying, yeah, I really like that. Not so mad about that, but, you know, rather than wait, let you... Because it's a very personal thing to... You know, you kind of grit your teeth sometimes when you send music off. Because you've just thought that music up from a paper edit or from what you're actually seeing on the rushes that you've been sent, or the first assembly of a film or whatever. And it's a real commitment. It's quite a leap of faith to send it through WeTransfer or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're nervous about it until... But she's fantastic. She'd always come back and say, I love that. Or if she doesn't, that's great as well.
And you talk about the nervousness there, and I hope this isn't too much of a personal question, but like, is you getting paid for something like that riding on their happiness of what you've done? Like, is that, would you agree a fee beforehand or like a day or something like that?
So
the nervousness isn't about whether you get paid for it. It's just whether get paid regardless. But
you want it to be a success.
You want it to be good, okay.
Yeah, you want it to work, and you want it to help tell the story that's being told. And if you can't do that, then you shouldn't be doing it.
What documentary part are you most proud of? Is there anything that you think that's really enabled the telling of that story?
I think, funnily enough, the first one I ever did, which was, I think, a BBC Two, is for the Correspondent series. And it was called Looking for Karadzic, about Radovan Karadzic. And I sort of really got my shit together for that. And I got some great violinists in, and I just sort of really, I really put my mind to it.
Yeah.
And that was with Fiona as well, actually. But it really worked. Lots of things I've been quite proud of. I've won a few... Just the New York Film Festival and stuff, a couple of awards for music for short films, and a couple of product placement things, a couple of corporate films, but they've been quite, you know, high, not necessarily budget, but high production standard stuff. Definitely cut the bit about me saying.
Here's a question. Can you explain how songwriting credits work in relation to contributions by session musicians in a studio?
Doesn't really, does it?
Right, next question. But how does that work? So if a musician says to you, oh, can you just put something together, and you write a nice hook that goes in, or like a solo or a little piece that brings up the song, you just get paid your day rate. And you get credit for any...
I think the thing to do in that case is put a big invoice in to cover any angst that you might feel later on when you don't get any.
Really? Can you write in your invoice, oh, this is because I wrote this part on this particular song?
Someone's got to sign that off, haven't they?
At what point, I guess the question is what point does the ownership of that idea you had in your head stop becoming your thing? That you own.
Well, I mean, Paul McCartney's got this thing that they jam, I think, at the beginning of a sound check for half an hour or something. Might even be longer than that. And he's made everyone sign, and then they may well release things at a later time. So if the keyboard player comes up with this killer riff, It doesn't matter. It's still owned by Paul McCartney.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
I mean, I'm not sure if this is going to allow to be said either, but I do know this to be the case. And, you know, if the Horns are play, come up with something, you know, like Superstition, but...
Yeah.
The new version of, you know, the better version of Superstition.
He can yoink that and that's his.
He can use that and...
Oh, really?
Shove it where he wants, yeah.
Right. And so how would you... So you talk about, like, putting in a big invoice. Is there anything else that you can do to... I don't know.
You're not going
to...
You're not... If
it's a difficult one, isn't it?
You're not going to get... You're not going to get a chunk of the a slice of the song.
No, and also what you're not going to get is the recognition.
Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not going to get the recognition as well, which has got to be just as troubling at times. I mean, is there anything that, you know, a particular song that you've played on that you think, oh, by the way, I just want to tell people that was me, or is there anything you're particularly proud of that you contributed towards?
Lots of things that I'm kind of pleased that I played on. But, you know, I mean, I haven't ever played on a massive number one sax. You know, I'm probably 10 years too young to have done that. You know, that was a real sort of 80s thing.
Yeah.
But that's my excuse anyway. I'm not like that, actually, I'm just shit.
Oh, come on, man. You've played with some fucking amazing artists.
But very, you know, there haven't been massive solos that I've played on particularly. But although the NME once, I got a letter from the NME in about 1991 or something saying, this is just to say that you've won. It's like the Monopoly cards, you know, the community chest. You've won second prize. You've won an award for playing the second best solo sax solo of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
What was it?
It was with the Wild Hearts. Do you remember them?
Yeah, I know of them, but I don't know their stuff.
No, I don't either. It was a session that probably one of the least favorite sessions that I can ever remember. But yeah, somebody's voted you to be the second best.
Well, I mean, that's still cool, man. I mean, we'll find it. It's shit.
It's second best. And it's a crap song, and it was pretty out of tune as well.
But, right.
That won't surprise anyone.
What does, in your new record, here's a question. What does the music convey in the instrumentals? What does the music say that obviously the words don't, because they're not there? What are you trying to say on that record? Is there any point you're trying to make, but through?
I think I'm trying to. I mean, honestly, there's no point to anything. Not full stop in the world.
That's like one of your drunken. You can do anything. You want.
There's no point. No, there's no point to anything on that track other than to write something that I thought was quite fun and that I wouldn't be too ashamed to play to pretty much anyone I know, including my wife who hates jazz, like seriously hates jazz, but even she will tolerate it. And the other day, a friend of ours' kids sent me a message. Her two kids, about 4 and 2 or something years old. And they sent me a message saying, "Hi Stevie, we played your record. It's really funny."
what feedback?
Yeah, and that is the point.
It's full of tunes.
But I sent a message that saying that's the best review I've ever heard of anything, because it's really funny.
It sounds energized. It sounds positive.
It's quite. There's a bit of lightness to it. It's not gloomy and you know. I think it's quite sunny and chirpy.
Put it on while everyone's suffering with coronavirus. Whack it on, it will lift your spirits.
But,
now,
yeah.
Miss Katie Pickles, that is the name of one of the songs.
That's
now,
right,
Katie Hamilton is your wife.
Yes,
who,
she is.
I met at after you played at the Palladium, which
is
a fucking brilliant after show. That's when she introduced me to her dad, and like this is where this came from. I'm guessing that song title is related to her. And tell us about that song and where that came in.
Well, I came up with this little ridiculous riff, and I thought, I'm going to really chop it around. And I got Mez Clough, the drummer, to kind of play lots of loops and stuff. And I cut it up. And it sounds very quite bizarre and fragmented. But it reminded me of what... Basically, when I go away for a weekend on tour or something and come back, that the whole house not only smells of vinegar but when I arrive back, but there are jars full of piccalilli and pickled onions and pickled turnips... with a little bit of beetroot in to make it all go all red. And there's a madness about this situation that Katie, she can't ever sit still and just do nothing. She has to pickle things. And that when I was sort of mixing that track, and I thought, God, this should be called Miss Katie Pickles.
So we're talking about all these amazing things you've done. What about disappointments? Regrets? We've all had a few.
We have, and we'll continue to have them. Yeah. One that sticks in my mind is I was sitting around having dinner with my kids and my wife just before the Olympics was going on.
2012 in London.
2012, yeah. And I was playing with Madness for the closing ceremony. And I bumped into Kate Hudson, who I'd previously met tenuously, I might add, but in the Saturday Night Live thing, she was hosting that with Radiohead. I'm clanging away here.
I'm awesome. Amazing.
So I was chatting to her, and suddenly, I go back to, I was having dinner with my kids and my wife, and they said, Dad, why don't you play with somebody good like Muse? And I said, I'd really like to, actually. That would be amazing. Anyway, so I'm talking to Kate Hudson, who happens to be married at the time.
To
Matt Bellamy, who were playing as well. And she said, Matt, come here, meet Stevie. And I'm suddenly thinking, oh, shit. And he this is absolutely what he said. He said, do you play baritone and tenor saxes? Can you do a series of gigs? We've got a couple of things. And I'm thinking... And I'm not thinking of this gig or him or the band. I'm just thinking of my kids' faces when I tell them... So he then whistles. I can't do it, but
yeah, you know, between your fingers, yeah.
You know, Tony, come over, Tony. So Tony, the manager, comes over. Can you take Steve's number? He's a baritone tenor player. He's perfect for his track. Can't remember the name of it, but it was happening at the time, and they were doing some promos for it. And he said, so it was all taken down, and thank you very much. Lovely to meet you. And he's from Tynmouth, and I was talking about my family come from around that Dawlish in Devon. So we're having this, and I thought, this is it. I've nailed it. So I'm going to go back to my kids, and I'm going to play with their favourite band, and they're going to fucking respect me.
Yeah.
Did I ever hear from them?
Oh, how disappointing.
Not a single thing. And until I saw them on Jules Holland with some other fucking saxophone player.
Cheating on you.
Yeah. So but that was quite funny, I thought. But
Just get the respect of your kids play into your mind a bit. Because that's quite a natural thing to want to have, I think. So this is a really interesting conversation. Because even if you're like, you know, the greatest musician ever... Kids are embarrassed of their parents, right? That's just always the case.
Definitely in my case.
Yeah, like always the case. Oh, yeah. And the reason this... A person coming up on the podcast soon is a guy called Everton Nelson. And I was very lucky to have a drink with him a couple of weeks ago. And he'd just come from the studio doing the new James Bond song with Billie Eilish. And he was like, I can never, ever ask for a photo with anyone, but my kids love Billie Eilish.
Yeah.
And so he said, I'm going to have to do it just this once off. And do you know what she did? She went, what's the kid's name? Said the kid's name. I'm going to do a video. Did a video and went, your dad's an absolute legend. And then switched the camera to him. And like now he's like the coolest dad ever.
Brilliant.
And then it created a discussion between me and my partner about like, that is a very rare case where kids are going to be super proud of their parents.
I've met Everton, I think.
Oh, do you know him? Right,
Years ago.
Amazing violinist, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. So does it play on your mind about like, wanting to get the kudos of your kids' like respect and stuff.
There's a point that I think you give up. the classic situation in the summer was I said to both my kids. Ted, who was 16, he did his GCSEs and then he went to Reading, and I was doing a gig in Clapham Common with Madness, and it was a bit. It's quite a good fun gig that it's all an all day.
It sounds a very Madness
and
gig.
And it was great fun, and there's loads of bands on them in the you know, and it was hot. It was perfect, you know. And I said to Ted, "Do you want to come?" He said, "No," and he sealed his the fate of him Aww. Being able to come to. He just didn't want to come, but Frank did. He said, "Yeah, can you give me?" Frank, who was 3 years old, is, yeah, give me 50 quid and I'll come. Which I did. So he got drunk. And then But we had fun after that, actually, because Martin Freeman, the actor, was there, and Katie, my wife, my tenacious wife, managed to persuade him to come back to the house with us.
Really?
Until about 5 o'clock in the morning. And and Frank, my oldest son, had already gone home with his back to the house. And I said, can you tidy up the house a bit? The Hobbit's coming home with us. He said, what are you talking about? Your dad, you're drunk. I said, no, the Hobbit's coming back. And he said, oh, fuck off. You know. And so we turned up with Martin Freeman back at our house. It's quite funny.
He's a cool dude, right?
He's lovely. He's and a genius music, you know.
He likes his music, right? God, he knows his stuff
everything.
Inside out.
Yeah, he knows everything about music, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, very smart guy. We had a lot of fun. He likes tea.
Who doesn't? We'll begin to wrap up. What's your most important piece of music memorabilia? So if the house was burning down and the family was safe, what were the things that you'd be grabbing?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I'd like grab Bitches Brew, which is not memorabilia, it's an album, obviously, but I've got a rather nice platinum disc from Radiohead that I'd grab.
Oh, yeah. Is that Kid A, right?
Yeah.
Nice.
And, yeah, I definitely grab that, I think. My instruments aren't memorabilia, are they? No.
Yeah, no, but is there a particular sax that you...
I've got a 1966 Tenor Mark VI, Selma Tenor Mark VI, that was apparently made the same week I was born.
Wow.
53 years ago, which I've had for many, many years. I'd grab I couldn't really leave that in the house. Yeah, that would break my heart.
We want to look after that. So let's wrap up by asking you, or should we ask you? Okay, let's go through. We talked about Noel Gallagher's band, and this is a band, you know, it's 5 years this week that we started this podcast, thanks to Mikey Rowe. If it hadn't been for Mikey Rowe, we wouldn't have done 75 episodes. Absolute legend.
Mikey Rowe!
Yeah, he's the man. I wonder if you could just like go through each of the artists we've had on, not all 75, but from Noel's band, and just tell us very briefly, you know, your thoughts on that individual, what they bring to the band. Let's start with Mikey.
Mikey is the speaker of the house. He's in charge, and he keeps the crazy people from dissenting and being ridiculous. he's a voice of reason, Mikey. And he's level, isn't he? He's very level. He's smart. Nothing flusters him. What's the question?
Just like what he brings to the band, I would say. Like so, yeah. So,
well, he I think he's a great leveler. He controls. He's you know, he's like from the bridge of the USS Enterprise, isn't he? You know, he's just he's there, and it's he adds a solidity to it, and he's a great keyboard player as well.
Amazing player.
But he doesn't dick around. You know, like a lot of players do. You know. Very, very solid, beautiful bloke. Real proper gentleman, Mikey.
He is, isn't he? Such a nice man. What, yeah. Ross?
He's a crazy motherfucker. he's joy, isn't he?
He is.
I love looking at his face when he's... Whenever he looks over at Chris, the drummer, he's... there's a slightly mad look in his face, but I love it. Very expressive face. Funny as fuck as well.
Really, really funny bloke.
He's hilarious.
So when I was with him and met Gem and was trying to convince Gem to come on the podcast, which he eventually did, I said to Gem, we had Steve Proper on, and Steve Proper said it was his favourite. It's 73 years old. He said it was his favourite interview he'd ever done. And like Gem was like, oh, right. And then Russ just cut across and just went, yes, because he's got dementia. I was like, oh, yeah, nice one. let's go. What about Gem?
Gem's like a cuddly teddy bear. There's something cuddly about him, and beautiful bloke. Amazing guitarist.
He is.
Beautiful sound, clarity. He's phenomenal, yeah. I can't imagine doing the gig with... Well, I can't imagine doing the gig with without any of those guys, actually, but he's there, isn't he? He's just...
I've got a picture up there of me playing his Gibson Firebird in his lounge. Yeah, which is probably one of my proudest ever moments when he recorded the podcast. And he is an absolute gentleman.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart. And
he's a class act in every way, I think.
Yeah, he's a real star without being a star. Mm. And there's something beautifully warm about him. Yeah, but he does remind me of a teddy bear that I used to have. I don't know why.
What was the name of the teddy bear?
It was called Jaffa.
Jaffa?
Yeah.
You'll have to tell him that.
I don't think I can. I think I might have to edit this out.
What about Wisey? What does she bring to the band?
Oh, she's amazing. She's phenomenal. Because when I first got, you know, sort of joined the band, so to speak, as a session player, the girls weren't in that. You know, there was no Jess, there was no Wisey. Mm. Charlotte wasn't there. And the dynamic changed so massively when they all came in, because it suddenly became... Bit of background, I hate stag nights. I hate just being in a room with loads of blokes. It just doesn't, you know, and it really...
You joined Noel Gallagher's
band. Yeah, I know.
Thanks to 20,000 lads. Fucking
business,
every night.
But when they came in, it was weight off your shoulders.
How did it change? What?
In every way.
Summarise it, what would be the...
It's difficult to... It's difficult to say how it changed, but it just became human rather than... Not that it was horrible, because it wasn't, but it became just like a family kind of thing with the girls, and, you know, they're all beautiful. I mean, they're you know, go on to Charlotte, I'm sure you can ask me about Charlotte. Absolute, you know, amazing people. YC is fantastic. I love her singing. Particularly, I watched it because I watched it back at the Jules Holland thing.
Yeah,
I was blown away by it. I thought she was nailed it, absolutely fucking amazing. Superb, you know. She's great. She's young. She hasn't got that much confidence, but she's amazing what she does.
Interesting. She played it. We do a live night at the Groucho Club, and she played it recently.
We were going to come, actually. Yeah.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Right. So she strikes me quite a very confident person. So that's interesting that you. Yeah, that's under the surface.
I think outwardly. But
interesting. Yeah. Let's talk. So Charlotte, we haven't had Charlotte on the podcast, but I'm sure we will at some point. She's been through a bit of a tough time, as we know. What does she bring to the band? Like, what's the dynamic she brings?
She brings batshit craziness.
Give us an example other than the scissors.
Well, she's disconnected from reality to such an extent that, you know, when you all turn up in the reception of a hotel or for a bus, if she doesn't say, where are we? And this is my poor
French accent.
French accent. Well, where are we going? Well, and everyone will just roll their eyes and think, shut up. but the love that everyone has for her, including me, is phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, I thought she was absolutely a barking lunatic when I first met her, if I'm honest. But I absolutely adore her. She's fantastic. And she just brings an absolute... I don't. It's impossible to say what she brings. And I bet everyone else in the band would say...
Exactly the same.
Similar. Yeah, probably, maybe more...
And Jess, what about Jess? I mean, Jess is close to our heart. She played a gig in this lounge. She's going to do another one soon. You know, she's done our Groucho night. She's been on the podcast. She's an absolute legend. She's set up loads of episodes for us. So say something nice.
She's amazing. Jess is incredible. She's a vegan.
Yeah, she is. And we had to do a five course vegan meal, and we nailed it. She was pleased with it. Yeah, it was good. My girlfriend wasn't that happy when she found out.
It's like having Is this a good thing to say, like being on tour with your sister? Is that a good thing to say?
I think that's a massive compliment.
I feel quite brotherly towards her. I don't know why.
And that's nice. Sure,
yeah. I think she thinks I'm a lunatic.
Why? What have you done that's lunacy?
I came from another gig with Madness and got to Bologna and went out and got drunk and was sort of walking down the hallway in the hotel, and she opened the door and said, "I thought it was you. It sounded drunk," something like that. But yeah, I don't know, something about it that I feel quite brotherly towards her.
That's awesome.
I doubt she feels the same thing. But I adore all of the girls. They're fantastic.
Now, Chris Sharrock, the night that me and you
met... The nicest man in the world.
He's such a nice bloke. We spent an hour talking. Like, he basically, a lot of people... One message I get on all the social medias over the last 5 years, why haven't you had Chris Sharrock on? And he said, and I have a lot of close friends with Chris, that he just doesn't want to share. Like he said, once something's out there, it's out there. And he just wants to be very private. I was like, that's fine. We spent an hour chatting, getting drunk. And it was the best episode we ever recorded that was never recorded, basically.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And at the end, he was like, shit, we should have done a podcast in the end. He's such a nice man. What does he bring to Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds?
He's part of the fact he's shit hot drummer. He's dry as fuck as well. I love his. He'll just say, so, you know, he's an introvert like me, actually. I think that's fair to say. He's quite quiet. I mean, Russ is the big
personality,
huge, you know. Yeah. And
Russ could be like an after dinner speaker in another lifetime.
Oh, but he could. And everything he says is funny. It's incredibly irritating, the fact that somebody can be that funny.
Have you seen his James Brown impersonation?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I'll show it to you after.
I bet it's fantastic. I bet it's better than James Brown, obviously. Yeah. Certainly funnier.
Yeah.
Yeah, it infuriates me with how people can so naturally be so entertaining without even trying.
Yeah.
But Chris is adorable, the sweetest guy ever. Kind, beautiful, great drummer. I stand right next to him. A bit bloody loud, but you know.
Okay, so last question. Yeah. What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might those fears be addressed?
Well, I think as far as songwriting goes, actually, I think the critical mass seems to be just around the corner, by which I mean the formulaic, horrid production of quite a lot of music that you can't tell what's what. And I think personality is going out of music hugely, where things aren't identifiable anymore because they haven't got a sound. They've just got the sound of whatever sells music, you know, sells units. And I think that's an incredible shame. Now more than ever, I think that's the case. I mean, there are some fantastic artists obviously around, but my fear is that the generic whitewash of noise that just sounds like everyone else. That's a bad fear. That's good enough, isn't it?
That is, yeah. I mean,
I also think that, you know, it's going to be sad when it happens that bands, the sizes of bands decimate, things go up and down as far as my interests are concerned, which is, you know, having a horn section in a band. It's a fad, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, it was brilliant. Amy Winehouse kind of brought it back. Loads of people, you know, used to be Dexys, Midnight Runners, Boomtown Rats or you know, whatever.
So the trend will dip again, and there won't be the need.
Up and down all the time, and nobody wants to hear it all the time. But my fear is blandness, actually. No personality, no identifiable kind of emotion going on.
I agree with that. The character has been taken out of music. I think that's a lot to do with the opportunity to do re-records all the time. You know, if you listen to Bob Dylan's final track on... Desolation Row has got, like, 12 minutes long, beautiful song, and there's little errors all the way through it, but that kind of brings the character to the song, whereas now you delete that and go do it again until it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's like all the characters have kind of been ironed out of the... You know.
And also, you know, when you watch the Grammys or something and you see that the 7 or 8 people who wrote it... It's like being in a conference room and having, you know, the annual general meeting in front of, you know, your the boss man and 6 other people, and then coming up with an idea. Dilution, that's what it is.
Too many cooks.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We've done like an hour and a half plus.
Fabulous.
Yeah, which has been fantastic. Thank you for your honesty. Thank you for your candor. We've had a few drinks. It's been enjoyable.
It's been wonderful.
It has been wonderful. And, you know, best of luck with the album. So Hamland, let's keep an eye out. You know, where can we find out more? So Steve Hamilton.
SteveHamiltonMusic.co.uk.
You look so certain as you said.
I don't know. I've got to tell you one thing.
It's a red wine.
But by the way, social media is not my thing. But you know, doing this album the other day, I thought, right, I've got to do something on Instagram. Now, I've never posted anything on Instagram. Yeah. I don't know how it works. So my son Ted told me how to do it, and I got this picture up and blah blah blah. And then Katie said to me, "Do you know the first thing about this, but do you know when the best time to post social media stuff is?" And I just looked at her and said, "February."
And on that note, good luck with the album. I mean, we've got some tough times ahead, but yeah. we've got some tough times ahead, but you know, people should buy this album. You know, people's gigs are being cancelled, and you know, there's some great stuff there. And if you don't buy the album, make sure that you're coming to the gigs later on in the year. And it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time. Thank you for celebrating the 5th year of the Stage F podcast. It's 5 years ago this week that Mikey Rowe first came in, so it's beautiful. We've got another.
Thank you, Chris. I've really enjoyed myself. Thank
it's
you
been
so
great
much.
Fun. So we'll see you again. Cheers, mate.
So thank you to Steve Hamilton for appearing on the Stage F podcast. Definitely can tell a few beers have got to the head by the end of it, which was kind of understandable. You know, we talk about coping mechanisms and stuff like that, and, you know, everything in moderation. But, you know, it was certainly recorded at a time that we thought, you know, we aren't going to see a lot of people for a long time, so let's make the most of it. It was an absolute pleasure to have him on. Do check out Hamlandy's album. I've been listening to it during lockdown, and it's so good. There's so many great tunes on there, so do check that out. Thank you for listening. As mentioned, if you're interested in the one-to-one life coaching sessions that I'm starting now, email stageleftnights@gmail.com, and we can kind of support you around that. And Boned from Oasis is going to be coming on the podcast. We haven't got a date yet. I do like to do these in person rather than over the Skype or the internet. I think it's easier to build rapport. I think it's better quality. So I'm kind of tempted to, seeing how things go, just hold back before recording new episodes till we can actually do some face-to-face stuff. But obviously that depends on when that's going to be. So, you know, just follow the Twitter, Facebook and Instagram for updates. Okay, thank you for listening. As mentioned, it's the 5th anniversary of starting the podcast. So as a bit of bonus content, I'm going to record something this week, which is kind of some reflections over the last 5 years, favourite stories, favourite episodes. Look out for that as well. Okay, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.